Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Amid the fallout from Missouri Supreme Court's ruling on the transfer from unaccredited school districts, a $23 million bill for tuition and transportation, but another legal shoe may be about to fall. Missouri's Attorney General has joined colleagues from all over the country in requesting new federal laws on prostitution and child sex trafficking. And the on-again, off-again Illinois concealed carry law is on again, eventually. I'm Don Marsh. Just some of the subjects for our legal roundtable panelists. With me in studio, attorneys Bill Freivogel, director of the School of Journalism at SIU in Carbondale, Mark Smith, assistant vice chancellor at Washington University and director of the Career Center there. And we're happy to have with us once again Michael Wolff, dean at the St. Louis University School of Law and former chief justice of the Missouri Supreme Court. Gentlemen, nice to have you with us again.
Good morning. Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. Okay, now Anthony Weiner has taken over the headlines from the Trayvon Martin verdict, but I want to backtrack to that just a little bit, Bill, and I'll start with you. The Castle Doctrine, which we have here in Missouri, Stand Your Ground, which we do not have. Are there any implications in Missouri in connection with this, in connection with the Trayvon Martin verdict?
Well, we have I think we're going to talk about in a few minutes this shooting on the Merrimack River and whether or not does that involve the Castle Doctrine. I mean, it used to be that you know, if you went back a century or a little bit more, the people had a duty to retreat if they were faced by some sort of danger. That sort of left American law over the past century, and states like Missouri passed the Castle Doctrine, which means if somebody comes into your house onto your property and you're feeling threatened, you can shoot them. And then Missouri expanded that to also include your car. And Illinois actually has a version of Stand Your Ground. Stand Your Ground sort of became really popular around 2006 and since then, which basically says that wherever you are, if you are feel as though you're under attack and you're threatened, you can use deadly force to defend yourself. And that's the situation we had in the Trayvon Martin case.
Well, you mentioned that it was extended beyond the house, the Castle Doctrine. The question is, Mark, does it extend to a sandbar outside your house?
So this case that occurred on the Merrimack, so far I haven't seen anything that suggests this guy, Crocker, I believe is his name, who discharged the gun and shot and killed the Mr. Dart, is no suggestion he's going to raise it. But I think there might be he might try this law that was passed, I think, a couple of years ago. It's called the Defense of Justification, that basically says you don't have a duty to retreat in Missouri anymore. We used to, but not anymore. And you can defend your home, but also your property. So the question becomes whether or not he felt he was in danger, and that'll be a question for the jury, and whether or not he was on his property, which brings to a really obscure area of the law called riparian rights, which riparian has to do with rivers and the land near rivers. So I actually read this 1954 Missouri Supreme Court case that talks about it, and it's specifically about the Merrimack. If you have a navigable river, one that boats, and they talk a lot about logs going up and down, then everyone has a right to be on it. But they say even though the Merrimack's not that kind of river, it's still – the public has a right to go up and down it. And a part of that right is the right to, like, if there's a barrier to get up and portage around it, to go onto sandbars. But the question, it's not completely clear. Does that mean you can go up to the high water mark, or does it just mean where the river usually is? Obviously, rivers change. It sounded like one person in this party went into the woods
to relieve themselves.
Yeah, to relieve themselves. So that sounds to me like that's not just in the riverbanks. That's farther. And I don't know where this argument occurred, but I think if it occurred up away from the riverbank, Mr. Crocker's probably got a much better case than if it occurred on a sandbar that's surrounded by the river.
Well, one of the people in the party, the voting party, had a rock in his hand,
right,
which was presumably considered a threat by Mr. Crocker.
But Mr. Dart, it sounded like,
the victim.
Did nothing like that and had no, everything I've read suggests he was trying to be a peacemaker rather than doing anything to suggest. So I think that raises a second interesting issue. This Missouri law, and we've kind of talked about this before, if You know, say Mr. Crocker was shooting at the person with the rots. He felt threatened, but it misses him and hits some guy across the river in a boat completely outside. Can he still use that defense? I think some people would argue, yes, he could. Now, this doesn't seem fair, and this particularly to the person who was shot, but I think that would be a smart lawyer may try and make that argument for him.
Well, we need to point out once again that he did not shoot the man with a rock. He shot someone.
Apparently
who was
the man closest
nearby.
To him is what he said.
What do you think, Mike Wolf?
I think that if somebody came down from his property who looked like that guy and had a gun in his hand, I don't know what legal doctrine I would be invoking, but I would certainly be skimming myself out of that territory about as quickly as I could.
Yeah.
Peace or no peace. I think that case is going to hinge on whom you believe.
Right.
In that sense, it has a little bit of commonality with Trayvon Martin because there was a question about who was being attacked and who was not being attacked.
The difference here is there are a lot more people around.
There were.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other thing is that we learn once again that it may very well be that alcohol and guns don't mix very well. But there are a lot of things that we don't know about that case, and so it's hard really to make an assessment other than to say that I don't think that guy came down with the idea that he was going to kill somebody, and I don't think that Mr. Dart had the idea that he was going to put his life in danger by
correct.
Being on a sandbar, and that's the tragedy of it.
It's a tragic situation, and, I mean, there's no way around that. It's just a horrible situation. You got to really feel for the family and the widow and I think this man had children and everything, so it's a horrible situation. I feel bad even talking about the legal issues because it's so fresh. But
and I think just as far as the facts are concerned, that Crocker has been charged with second-degree murder, right. And that I believe I heard the sheriff saying that the Castle Doctrine would not apply
right.
because he was not in fear of his life. Now, you know, maybe the rock throwing. But the rock holding person would enable him to argue, well, I actually was in
right.
fear of my life.
To the notion that he didn't come down with the idea of killing somebody, he did come down with a gun,
right, he did.
Which is halfway there, you know, and mm-hmm. You pull the trigger and that's a totally different story.
Right, right.
Okay, another aspect of the Trayvon Martin case which has perplexed me somewhat is the fact that the jury in that case during its instructions, was told about the Florida Stand Your Ground law. However, this issue did not come up as part of the defense. And that's what bothers me somewhat. Mike, I think you indicated you had some thoughts about that.
I don't know why that came into the case by way of the jury instructions. But I will say this, that in many instances, a trial judge will do the instructions in a way that the defense doesn't have much grounds to object. And so the question is, and I don't know whether the defense asked for them, but if the defense asked for them, she might have given the instruction just because if the person gets convicted, then they've got an issue on appeal right. about the jury instructions. You give a what looked to me like a pro-defense set of instructions, and the person gets acquitted, well, there's no review. Mm-hmm. The prosecution can't appeal the fact that the judge gave those instructions. So oftentimes it's a matter of erring on with jury instructions, it's erring on the side of the defendant because you may have a feeling that the case is going to go the way it's going to go no matter what you tell the jury. That sometimes is the case.
But this is the kind of thing that I think that confuses a lot of lay people about the law.
And lawyers. And judges.
Thanks for pointing that out. That's very reassuring.
Well, I'm just here to help.
I mean, I think that Zimmerman could – they could have tried to claim, well, you can't even take us to trial because mm-hmm. of Stand Your Ground. They didn't take that position. But then, you know, I guess I felt as though just sort of vaguely following the trial – that I expected the jury to convict Zimmerman of manslaughter instead of second-degree murder. But then when I actually read the jury after the verdict, when I actually read the jury instructions, I really couldn't see how you could come up with anything other than an acquittal because it basically said, you know, that the jury had to consider that, you know, if he was in a place where he could legally be and if he felt threatened And in light of Trayvon Martin being younger and stronger, and if there was any doubt about it, it had to be, for acquittal. You could sure see that an acquittal was a reasonable verdict for this jury to come to, even if you might not feel like it's just.
And so I think one of the interesting things that could happen next would be a civil lawsuit by Mr. Martin's family. And so this would be kind of like what could be like what happened with O.J. Simpson. O.J. Simpson was acquitted on the criminal, and the standard for criminal is beyond a reasonable doubt, like 99%. A civil lawsuit, you only have to be more likely than not, preponderance of the evidence, 51%. So and there might be enough evidence to then say that, that this was some kind of tort or other wrongful act, and that they would be able to collect damages. Now, there would be much wider probably discovery before, and who knows what would come out.
Collect damages. I don't remember much damages being collected in the O.J. Simpson case, if I remember correctly.
Well, they hounded him a great deal, Mr. Zimmerman, I don't think, has any money. And I'm not sure that what that is. But the real point about these cases is, and these are not uncommon cases around the country, and there is an overlay of race in the case. There's an overlay of people's fear about protecting their neighborhoods and so forth. So cable news puts that up as kind of the marquee case of the year. These are almost always situations that have that kind of component. You can look at it through the lens of race and come to really quite wildly differing viewpoints on what the justice of the case is. I have a tendency in those situations to trust that the jury has a sense of what the justice of the case is. Not always, but most of the time, probably more so than I do.
I get the impression that must have been a very interesting jury room, given what we've heard from some of the jurors since then and how they kind of moved around and switched their positions on things. But the bottom line was that they had to respect what the law was at the time and act accordingly.
And they try very hard to follow the law as the judge gives it to them.
Yeah. One thing that I think is unlikely to happen is I don't think it's very likely we're going to have a Rodney King kind of follow-up federal prosecution. I mean, potentially you could. It could potentially be a hate crime prosecution, but there's a really high level of proof of a specific intent to commit the act with a racial motive, and it seems unlikely that they have that evidence unless they come across some new evidence.
I agree.
I have to take a break, but very quickly, is there any kind of a time limit on filing a civil suit? I have not heard that the Martin family is definitely going to do that.
There's statute of limitations. I don't know what it would
be. In Missouri, it's 3 years.
Yeah. So it would be a matter of years,
case,
right,
and I don't know what Florida's is. Sure, so it's whatever the state statute limitations.
It's a reasonable period of time.
Right.
They have some
is.
Time to
yeah.
think about that. Right. Okay. Let's take our break now, come back and talk about some other things. This is our Legal Roundtable Day, and my guests in studio are Mike Wolff, the dean at the St. Louis University School of Law, former Chief Justice of the Missouri Supreme Court. Bill Freivogel is also with us. He's at SIU in Carbondale. And from Washington University, Mark Smith. Back to continue this conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back to our Legal Roundtable panel discussion. Before we continue this conversation, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. There was an announcement this morning about an agreement to clean up the old Carter Carburetor site on North Grand. Fast food workers in St. Louis and six other cities who say the minimum wage is too low are striking today. And in a few minutes, Governor Nixon will appear in Clayton to defend his veto of HB 253, the income tax cut. These stories and more beginning at 3 on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day on stlouispublicradio.org. Okay, on with our discussion of things legal. I'd like to turn now to the Turner case, the famous school accreditation case. And, Mike, I'll start with you. We have learned that this is going to cost the unaccredited districts, the transportation costs and tuition costs, sending the students to other districts. It's going to cost $23 million. Just out of curiosity, you were on the Supreme Court when this was decided. Did the question of money and the cost of all of this come up?
No, not really. under the school foundation formula, the money that has to be paid has to come out of the failing school district's funds, which are state funds and local property tax funds. And the transfer is oftentimes made just by an adjustment of the state portion of the aid. But $23 million is $23 million. That means you have fewer children to educate, but you also have fewer resources to do it. I'm sure the legislature, when it passed the statute, was aware of that. I think the legislature for sure wanted two things. One was to make sure that the districts stayed accredited and did the job they were supposed to do. And the second was that if they didn't, that the children would be cared for. Now, they didn't tell anybody in the state, including the courts, how to allocate that or how many kids Clayton had to take before Clayton could say, enough, we have already enough, or Parkway or any other school district that's not failing. And then on the transportation side, the statute also passed by the legislature. And I keep emphasizing that the legislature created this, and the court merely read what the legislature did. The first time we read it, it was 4-3, and the last time the Supreme Court read it, it was 7-0. And the reading was consistent, and that is that the school district that sends the kids has to pay. The transportation, however, the statute on transportation says that they have to send them, they have to pay for transportation to another accredited district, but that the sending district, the failing district, can decide which districts they're going to provide transportation to. And I think the sensible part of that, about that was that if they picked 15 districts and they had five kids going to each of 15 districts, that's not a critical enough mass to justify putting a bus. You might be putting them in taxi cabs and things like that. So, but I think it also allowed districts to game the system by saying, okay, we'll pick Francis Howell. That's out of ways in St. Charles County. Or we'll pick Melville. That's about as far down on the river as we can get. But other school districts are certainly obligated to take those children, but the transportation may have to be provided by the parents, as the statute reads.
Yeah. I was under the impression that a judge is now considering a case, though, whereby the unaccredited district must pay transportation costs to any accredited district that the student might choose to go to.
Well, it's all about how you read the statute, and that's a possible reading of it, but it's not a likely reading of it because it says an accredited district and a district and district chosen by the sending school district. I mean, I thought that was an oddity in it, but we as judges have to pay attention to what the legislature, the actual words they used, and those are the words.
That's pretty much like what we were talking about with regard to the Trayvon jury. Mm-hmm. You don't make the law, but you have to follow the law as it is written, and mm-hmm. you have no opportunity to add or amend.
Well, I think that's right, and I'm not sure how that comes out, but I think that there probably will be some parents who may be taking their kids to school districts other than Francis Howell in one case and Melville in the other case, or arranging transportation or carpool or something like that. So it may very well be that the transportation becomes less of an issue, but it's still a problem under the law.
It's a 40-mile round trip in both cases, I believe. Yeah. Any thoughts, Bill and Mark, on
Well, the other thing that I find is interesting is these accredited school districts, do they have to take all the students? The legislature, certain members of the Education Committee have said, yes, that's what we intend. You can't say no to them. But there were some guidelines issued, and they were just advisory, not by the Missouri Board of Education, that I think came through the State Education Department. But anyway, mm-hmm. My reading suggested that there might be times when you wouldn't, that they were contemplating if you got too many applications for your spots that you could do lotteries and stuff like that. So I think that'll continue to be worked out because one can imagine if I have I've got one grade in this school and it's full with 30 kids and that's what we like. And if I have 10 people coming, I do two classrooms of 20, that's much less efficient. There's going to be extra costs. So how do you handle that kind of situation?
Well, there was some discussion about some of these districts changing the mandated size of their classroom and making them smaller so they wouldn't have to take these kids. Mm-hmm. Because once again, there's a very strong racial overtone to this whole process this time.
There's also the point that we rely upon. We have a system that relies upon local support of local schools. And one of the most attractive things that you can do to gain that kind of local support in districts where the electors care about it is to say we're going to have a class size that's no bigger than a certain number. Now, whether that makes sense educationally or not, it does make sense politically, and that's how you gain support for your local schools. That's how the schools of Clayton and Ladue and Kirkwood and those districts and Parkway, they function fairly well that way.
Okay, any other thoughts on this one? Should we move along, Bill?
I was just – it struck me that some of the reactions of some of the county districts were a little bit reminiscent of what would that have been 30 years ago when the school desegregation case was at play. And, it's sort of too bad to see sort of race either overtly or as a, you know, as sort of a behind-the-scenes kind of force coming to play again.
Yeah. You know, one thing that sticks in my mind about that particular era, and it involves Melville. I remember covering the situation down there. There was a lot of opposition to busing city kids into the school district until they realized they were going to have a better football team. And I'm serious. That really changed a lot of attitudes in that particular
brought a lot of money into their districts, too.
That is very, very true. Okay, let's move on. Ronnie White is back in the news. We all remember, I think, most of us remember that Ronnie White was nominated to become a federal judge back in the 90s, I guess it was. And John Ashcroft, then senator, refused to support him, and as a result, Mr. White did not get the judgeship. Now,
and it was more than refused to support him; it was he kind of torpedoed him.
He held him back. But now it looks like he might be back again. Thoughts on that?
Well, Ronnie White is my good friend. I served with him on the Supreme Court of Missouri for a number of years, and he's a very fine man and I think a distinguished judge. And I have to say also that he got caught in the politics of judicial confirmations in an awkward time when, as you may recall, Governor Carnahan was running for the U.S. Senate,
right.
and Ronnie was an appointee to the Supreme Court of Mel Carnahan's, and then the Pope came to town, and there was the commutation of the death sentence, and then the death penalty became an issue, and they said, well, there are some cases where Ronnie White dissented on the death penalty, well, overlooking, of course, the fact that most of the cases that he sat on, I think in death penalty cases, at least up to that point, he had voted to affirm death sentences. So it was kind of a bogusy, campaigny kind of issue.
But it got the job done in terms of what Senator Ashcroft wanted to do.
Well, as a matter of fact, yeah, there was an agreement that the vote would be taken on a number of nominees, right. And Senator Ashcroft asked the Republican caucus to oppose him uniformly.
Because I think Bond had kind of been pro White up until that point, and then it was a strict party vote in the full Senate that defeated him.
And I think also as people will find that Governor Ashcroft later, after his time in public office, apologized to Ronnie for the pain that he caused him and his family. And I think that's probably a decent and reasonable thing to do. But it was about politics, not about qualifications. And I think people will see that nomination as righting a wrong, an injustice.
Well, in this Congress, I wonder. Senator McCaskill is certainly behind him, but President Obama has had some difficulty with his judicial appointments lately.
Well, I think they'll work these things out.
By the way, he is not the only potential candidate. We read – this is from Heather Cole, by the way, our friend of the St. Louis Lawyers Weekly, who they broke this story. This would be to replace Federal Judge Gene Hamilton. But a couple of other names being mentioned are U.S. Magistrate Dennett Baker and also Circuit Judge Jimmy Edwards here in St. Louis. So there are some other names out there.
Both very fine jurists. But I think the White House nod will go to Judge White.
You know, we sometimes talk about what a divisive political scene we have now. But the time that Mike was just describing, I'm not sure there's been a time that was quite as divisive as that. You know, it came back to haunt Ashcroft because mm-hmm. it became an issue in his confirmation proceedings whether or not he had acted properly. And I'm wondering, Mike, is that a piece of I know you've said before that Ashcroft apologized to mm-hmm. White. Has that ever been reported anywhere?
I'm not sure.
That may be a piece of news you observed it, didn't you?
I did.
At an inauguration?
Yeah, at Governor Blunt's inauguration in 2005.
Well, you know, I'm glad to hear that, and I think a lot of people probably are after all of that all of that mess. Very quickly, a couple of things here I'd like to just get your comment on. There are some suggestions that the gas chamber may be restored here in Missouri. Attorney General Koster is apparently making sounds that could happen because of the suit filed by death row inmates who claim that propofol, the drug that's used in lethal injections, is cruel and unusual punishment. Thoughts?
I've seen the gas chamber in the old walls.
Isn't it a tourist attraction now? That's what
it
I've
is.
Heard.
It yeah. is. It's a two-seater. It was.
Does it have a half moon on the?
No, there's two chambers because I think at one point they did have a double execution in the 30s when it first opened. And I think the first time they used it, they didn't have the chimney up high enough, and the gas wafted into some of the other buildings and made some people sick. But it's had a storied history, and it was done as a humane replacement to hanging because hangings used to be done. Originally, hangings were done at the courthouse where the conviction occurred. And then they brought it inside, as it were, outside of the public viewing. And in the gas chamber, there's a window going in, and you see the death chamber, and there are observers, and that's still true in the lethal injection case. And I think in part the gas chamber resurrection, I don't expect really to happen, was because the state is having trouble getting the right drugs or mm-hmm. the right amounts of drugs or the maker of whatever those drugs are is a little gun shy about, if I can use that expression, about having them used in human executions.
I don't know if it would make anyone on death row feel any better to learn that it's not going to be lethal injection. It's going to be the gas chamber. But either way, the result's the same.
Yeah, right. My sense is Governor Nixon has kind of said he doesn't seem enthusiastic about this idea.
Another thing concerning our attorney general here in Missouri, he has joined 49 other attorneys general across the country in lobbying Congress to update laws dealing with prostitution and child sex trafficking. Why this push? Anybody have any idea?
Well, there may be other reasons, political reasons, but I think it's a good idea. I think he's been one of the real leaders on it. You talked about 47, but I think he's been one of the real leaders. And the idea is there's a federal law, and there was some question whether that would keep state prosecutors from – and they want to make it clear that, no, state prosecutors can go after, because apparently a lot of this kind of online prostitution, sex trafficking is occurring on the internet, and they want to be able to go after those people. I'm fine with that.
That seems – the online component seems to be the big one here, Bill.
Yeah. I think it may be that the attorney general could be considering a run for governor.
Yeah.
And that could be some motivation. I mean, this involves Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which despite its name actually protects a lot of indecency on the World Wide Web. There's actually a good reason for doing it in that it has allowed the internet to become so powerful and a place for free expression. A lot of that free expression is pretty ugly. I don't know if it's I'd have to do some more thinking whether it's a really great idea to have local prosecutors or state attorneys general able to do a lot of investigating of the content of material that's posted on the web.
I heard coming in today that the feds have arrested 150 people today for these very charges. So it's clearly a problem.
Well, there's local authorities that use the internet to grab people who are where they have police officers and sheriffs posing as young girls,
right?
And then they go nab the.
So I think it's already happening. So what's your concern?
Here's the deal: money things up.
So
do you want the prosecutors having investigations of Craigslist? I mean, there have been some investigations of that kind, but like Craigslist is. they're immune from prosecution under federal law. And you know, the whole point of the Communications Decency Act is that that internet sites are legally immune from anything that a third party posted on it.
Yeah, to
and
providers.
That's probably a good idea.
Okay,
before we take our break, and I want to get to the Supreme Court following the break, but maybe we can wrap up the Illinois conceal and carry situation. As we all know, that is now law, but it's not going into effect until next March, I believe. Is that correct? What is going on here? Why so long to implement this law?
Well, I just think it's sort of like all the procedures that have been set up as part of the law. If you have I think they're called FOID cards in Illinois, then you have to, you know, go through some procedures to actually get a concealed carry permit. I mean, what happened here was the legislature overrode what's called an amendatory veto by Governor Quinn. Illinois has this sort of unusual procedure where a governor can just sort of change some of the words in a law that's called an amendatory veto. But there was a large, greater than three-fifths majority overriding that. I think Quinn thought that he wanted more clarity on where guns could not be in public. I think as a result, so the law goes into effect, and Attorney General Madigan has said the court case that had struck down Illinois' previous law is now moot, and she will not appeal for that reason to the U.S. Supreme Court.
So basically, it's kind of a housekeeping thing, getting the law ready to be implemented.
I think sort of. I mean, there are a lot of sort of questions remaining, such as, I guess Chicago has the power to ban assault rifles. I think there's some questions to whether or not some of the Chicago suburbs will be passing laws of that kind. One of the issues that the Quinn was raising was if you just have a restaurant where less than 50% of your business is liquor, should you be able to have a concealed gun in that restaurant? And apparently he wanted to change it so you couldn't. But apparently the law will permit it, although the owner of the premises can still put up a sign, post it to keep out the gun.
And apparently – and I don't remember this in Missouri. Apparently there's some pushback. Some of the restaurants are starting to put those postings up, and then they're organized boycotts, and so it's become controversial. I don't remember that in Missouri when we started seeing those.
I don't either, but
– I wonder why that is.
We'll see.
All righty, let's take another break and come back and talk about some other things. This is our Legal Roundtable discussion with Bill Freivogel, Michael Wolff, and Mark Smith. And we'll want to get you into the conversation at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. And we'll take a tweet at STL on air. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our discussion about the law and legal issues with our Legal Roundtable panelists. Since we last got together, the U.S. Supreme Court made three rather significant decisions, one concerning the Defense of Marriage Act, the other concerning gay marriage, Proposition 8, the California law, and the other, the Voting Rights Act, which I think actually they had ruled just before our last session. Anything we need to bring up with regard to that? It's sort of old news now, but... It's still very much in the public conversation, Bill.
Well, the Voting Rights Act has gotten back in the news a little bit in the last few days. So the Supreme Court struck down Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, which was the coverage provisions that determined what parts of the country were covered under what is called Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which is the preclearance provisions, which means if you're basically one of the southern states, you got to get preclearance for any change in election procedures. So with Section 4 thrown out as being sort of based on antiquated data, Section 5 really couldn't be enforced. Well, now what the Justice Department did last week is they said we're going to use a different section of the law, actually Section 3, to what's called bail-in Texas and maybe in the future other jurisdictions. So the federal government can say, hey, look at your recent behavior. Texas, you were just found to be discriminating against Hispanics and the congressional reapportionment just last cycle. So your recent behavior shows that you really need to preclear your election changes. And that got Governor Perry very angry, saying that they were going around the Supreme Court. I think it's probably the only sort of strong position that the Justice Department has, in that I don't think Congress is going to update. I mean, theoretically, under the decision, Congress could update the coverage provisions of Section 4 using up-to-date data. But there doesn't seem to be any kind of political consensus for how to do that.
Is this on its way back to the Supreme Court then? I mean, if Texas basically – if Texas basically disagrees with Attorney General Holder on this.
I guess they can try.
I think there'll be a fight. There'll be a fight about it. Yeah. And Texas is not going to just take it.
And the federal government has a higher burden under your Section 5 cases than it did – I mean, under Section 3 cases than under the Section 5 cases. So it'll – it's an uphill climb for them, and maybe in the meantime, the Democrats will populate Texas so that the whole thing will be moot. Am I wrong?
But there's a lot of action in Texas right now to take advantage of this most recent Supreme Court ruling and amend the laws rather severely, which would work to the disadvantage of minorities in that state.
Didn't Texas reimpose the redistricting map that but before the court had said was discriminatory? And I think
that's true.
Yeah.
And they're getting into voter ID and all the rest of it, and student IDs are no longer valid for voter registration. While we're on this subject, let's take a call from Jerry in O'Fallon, who wants to talk about voting rights, then we'll move on. Go ahead, Jerry.
Good morning. I was just over the weekend reading North Carolina has proposed some, I think, even more stringent than Texas, including mandatory ID, but not accepting not only student IDs, but there's various others. I'm sorry, I don't have this in front of me. Also, what sounds kind of extreme in that the polls say close at 7 o'clock, and if you're in line, too bad. You know, your right to vote ends at a certain period of time, even if you're physically at the polling place. Among other restrictions, which kind of sounds like, you know, the entire smorgasbord of extreme restrictions. I wonder if you had any comment on that.
Well, I think Texas is doing the same thing, if I've read it correctly.
But I there was an E.J. Dionne op-ed or something in the paper over the weekend. I saw that too. And, yeah, they talked about, I think it was North Carolina. And you could – another thing they're prohibiting is anyone be paid – for voter registration drives, so that would, you know,
leave
out of it. Right, exactly. Right.
So we can bring the poll tax back.
And no college IDs as ID, right.
Speaking about bringing something back, I want to talk about Justice Scalia for a moment and get your ideas on some of the things he's been saying recently. He just keeps talking, doesn't he, Justice? He's talking about judicial activism and the Holocaust. He brings the two together. Now, he's talking about and is concerned about what he calls laws enacted in the spirit of the age. In other words, the Holocaust is the kind of thing that can happen when people get caught up in, let's call it, mass hysteria, for lack of a better word, as was the case in Nazi Germany. And I guess by inference, we take that to mean that people get caught up in the spirit of today's age with regard to such hot-button social issues as abortion and gay rights and that sort of thing. What are your thoughts about what he's saying?
It's a stretch. Yeah. But I think it has become fashionable in some circles to point out when we talk about the rule of law, and that's something that all of us as Americans hold sacred. And then what you can really do is you can make the case that Germany in the Nazi era was a highly legalistic society. And all of those things that we call the Holocaust and the awful persecution of the Jews and others, were pursuant to law. Law authorized that. And so I think this is what Scalia is trying to conflate: the idea that we become a highly legalistic society, that all we bring these things in and then follow the trend of the times and embody them in law, rather than going back to the immutable principles of 1787 when our Constitution was enacted.
But when on our law said slavery was okay too.
Well, and blacks counted as three-fifths in terms of the population.
Although slavery was never mentioned in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
The word never appears.
I think that from what I've read of various accounts of this, Justice Scalia said this at a meeting of the Utah Bar,
I think. Right.
And it seems as though there had been a speaker the previous day who had talked about – who had actually talked about the complicity of the legal system, sort of like Mike was just referring to, in implementing the Holocaust. And so to a certain extent, I think that, that then Scalia the next day – you know, is beginning his remarks with this kind of this reference to the previous day's speech. It's probably he should be smart enough, I think, not to necessarily make the, you know, the to if you try to say your opponents or have something to do, something like Nazis, it's you're probably reaching too far.
Yeah. Yes. It seemed like a very tortured example to be using.
You only get one Hitler reference in a lifetime. Okay, yeah, let's just make it a rule. And you should probably have some unpublished thoughts.
But he is making these comments supposedly to bolster his case for originalism. And in my notes here, it says that the Constitution should be interpreted as the framers originally intended. Mm-hmm. Well, how in the world can anybody presume to do that? I mean, 225 years later.
I think one of the strengths of our Constitution is that each age takes those words and makes those words meaningful in the context of the society in which we live. And we've had to, you know, we had a civil war about something unresolved in the original Constitution, and we enacted some amendments to the Constitution following the Civil War. We changed the way we elect United States senators. So we've done a lot of modifying through direct changes, but we've also interpreted things as to suit the needs. And I think that that's what keeps our Constitution alive. In fact, I think ours is probably the oldest Constitution now, when you think about it, in terms of the form of government. Most of the constitutions of the world are much younger than ours.
Just think about the words equal protection that were in the 14th Amendment and then sort of brought over to the 5th Amendment. And the way, you know, and when that was initially written after the Civil War, it really only was thought to, you know, apply to African Americans. And even for them, it didn't mean you would have desegregated schools.
Right.
Well, you know, then it came to include women. It came to mean that you had to get rid of segregation. And just in the same-sex marriage case, it came to mean that the federal government couldn't discriminate against same-sex marriage.
But these are laws enacted in the spirit of the age, everything we've just talked about, which he opposes. Are they not?
Well, I think there's good spirits and evil spirits. How's that?
It sounds like a lawyer to me.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I think it's very hard to – you know, what you were saying, Don, is how do you know what these guys were thinking 250 years ago? I think that's very difficult, particularly given all this technology. I've said this before. I always view the Constitution, it's like your wedding vows. It's not supposed to decide all the issues. It gives you the big picture agreement, but it doesn't say how many times a month you get to go play poker. It doesn't say how many times, you know, all these other things, who's going to cook breakfast and who's – that's got to be worked out, and it evolves.
Mm. Wasn't it Thomas Jefferson who said that the Constitution should be rewritten every 19 years in order to reflect the spirit of the particular age?
Now, in Scalia's defense, this living – what he says, well, where's our basis? Where do we know where to draw? And I get that, but I don't see it as a big issue.
Well, you know, there's an irony in this too, and that is we know that things change and conditions change. In the Voting Rights Act, one of the things that Justice Scalia specifically articulated against the Voting Rights Act – was that it was out of date, that it was no longer needed. Well, there is a branch of government that deals with updating laws that are out of date. It's called the legislature.
Yeah.
So this whole thing about what's judicial activism and what's not judicial activism really comes down to I kind of know it when I see it, and the things that I see I may not like. But there are some other kinds of judicial activism, if you want to call them that, that I like. So the whole term has become, to me, rather meaningless.
Yeah. Right.
The question is, has a branch of government done something that really more properly belongs to another branch of government? And I think in the Voting Rights Act, I think the critics of that decision have it right, that the judiciary overstepped its bounds in striking down something for being out of date. And so there are there's certainly a lot of play, but I don't think that the words judicial activism add really anything to our understanding of the situation.
Yeah. I have an email here that is sort of out there. I think this may be something that you gentlemen are not ready to talk about. Can your panel talk about the recent series of hearings from a U.S. Judiciary Subcommittee on copyright law as it relates to digital rights and licensing practices? Congressman Smith, Missouri, is on that committee. I understand they will come to some kind of a decision affecting new regulations this week. Does anyone know anything about what implications this might have for companies like Pandora or Spotify? Again, that's a little bit kind of off the charts for the kind
above
of discussions.
Sounds like something I should know about, but that I don't.
Yeah.
There's something called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which basically says that if you're an online operation, that if somebody notifies you that you've got copyrighted material and then you take it down, you're not going to get sued for copyright. I don't know how this Judiciary Committee thing relates to that, though.
This really brings to mind something we've talked about many times in the past, and that is the need for the law to catch up with what's going on in today's digital world, because it's moving so quickly.
To keep up with technology and, I think, keep up with social ideas, too. I mean, that's the challenge with the law. When you have a static set of rules, society doesn't stay static, and technology certainly doesn't.
Well, we've got to be careful about laws that reflect the spirit of the age, Mark. So be careful.
I'm properly chastised.
Mike Wolf, just a moment with you about your law school moving downtown. Bring us up to speed. It's, what's going on with all of that?
It's an exciting prospect. We've moved our operations down to 100 North Tucker, right next door to the Civil Courts building, right in the heart of the legal community in downtown St. Louis. I think that the faculty who are in the process of moving and the staff are thrilled with how the building came out. I mean, it's a gorgeous facility. It is state of the art. And I think that the connections that we can have in terms of bringing the legal profession into our building and bringing our students out into various aspects of the legal profession really is an exciting development. And we really expect it to be a gathering place for lawyers, judges, and students. We have a fine restaurant that's going to open in a couple weeks, in addition to the building opening in another week. In 2 weeks from now, I think the Docket, the main floor restaurant, which is operated by the same people who do the food service at Washington University and who do the new museum, St. Louis Art Museum, the Panorama Cafe. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be, I think, in the top floor with the huge courtroom with all the glass that people can see from the outside. It's really a dynamic and well-designed facility, and we're looking forward to having our students come and experience that.
Is it going to be better for the students simply because they're going to be rubbing shoulders with people from the profession who tend to congregate downtown?
I think that's part of it. I think that there's something growing up about going downtown and being among the legal community that's a little bit different than different field and having a class classes on a regular campus. I think our legal clinics will have an extraordinarily good experience in terms of raising their profile. They do wonderful work with underserved populations in St. Louis. We both have our own legal clinics and the Catholic Legal Assistance Ministry, which does a lot of work with immigrants who are in need of legal services. And we're really thrilled to have all these things in the same location and so accessible to the public and to the courts.
We were talking on the way up because I was at the law school, at WashU's Law School, when we moved buildings. And I didn't think it would have that big of an impact. And it really did. Students were really proud to be in the new building. And I think this is going to be extraordinary.
And it really was designed to mean to bring people together, to have a community. There's a lot
of spaces. Plus you get the excitement of downtown. I think that's great.
How'd you get it done so fast?
Had very good builders. The Clayco and the good architects at Lawrence Group. I can't say enough good things about those folks. Really, they've really done a wonderful job.
Only a couple of – how many students do you have in the law school?
I think about 700 or so this coming year.
Oh, yeah. 700 more lawyers about to
– No, they don't all come out at one
time. Yeah.
Some of them take a little longer than others, you know. And we're sensitive to the needs of the community. Our law school is getting smaller. WashU is getting smaller. I think the number of people going to law school currently is a bit smaller, but I think we're – we're well in tune to the needs of our community, and I'm hopeful that we can solve some of the problems that we have with financing children's, I mean, not children's, students' educations and making sense out of it in a way that we used to make sense out of it.
Good luck to you and to them with the new school. We've got to end it right there. I want to thank Bill Freivogel. Thanks for being with us. Freivogel, thank you for being with us. Mike Wolf, thank you. And Mark Smith, thank you. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about a book detailing the history of the Del Mar Loop. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.